From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court takes up President Trump's remain in Mexico policy as Elon Musk strikes a $44 billion deal to buy the social website Twitter. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, editorial board member Alicia Finley and columnist Kim Strassel. Welcome to you both. On Tuesday morning, the justices are hearing Biden v. Texas, a case, an appeal that concerns the Biden administration's effort to end the remain in Mexico policy created by President Trump. And let's start here with a clip from Chief Justice John Roberts probing a little bit during the oral argument.
There is no limit, as you read the statute, to the number of people that you can release into the United States, right?
Congress did not create a limit in that statute, but of course it's Congress itself that's making these appropriations decisions about
well,
how much
right.
space
but,
to give
but,
us.
But if Congress wants to be, there to be the release of a significant or whatever number, all they have to do is not fund the detention facilities to keep the number low, and then you would have whatever authority you want to extend the number of people released into the United States as you want.
So, Alicia, this case is a little bit procedurally complicated, but maybe the place to start is just remind us, what is the Remain in Mexico policy and what is at stake in this case?
So the Trump administration in early 2019 implemented this policy that requires migrants, mostly who are seeking asylum, to remain in Mexico while waiting for their cases to be heard. This was intended to deal with the problem of catch and release, in which the government would basically apprehend migrants crossing the border and then release them into the United States because we don't have enough detention capacity. I think the Department of Homeland Security has said that only has about beds for 34,000 migrants. And just to give you, we're getting hundreds or more than 100,000 every month right now. So there's clearly not enough detention capacity in the country. And what was happening, again, was that the Border Control or ICE was just releasing these migrants into the country. So the Trump administration invoked this power under this 1996 bipartisan immigration law that allows it to return migrants to a contiguous territory, in this case, Mexico. It could have also applied to Canada, to wait for their immigration cases to be heard by, you know, asylum officers and judges. This was mainly, it acted as a deterrent to people who are coming here illegally because they wouldn't automatically get admission to the U.S. Fast forward, this was litigated by some Democratic states. They sued to block it. The Supreme Court ultimately, you know, stayed a lower court injunction. So it continued. But the Biden administration came in, first day in office, Biden ordered a suspension of the policy and directed his DHS acting secretary at the time to review the program. And last June, the DHS secretary terminated it, issuing a pretty brief memo saying that it did not believe the policy was in the public interest, laying out a few reasons, saying it wasn't humane and such. Then you had GOP states come in, or Republican states led by Texas come in and sue and saying that your reasons aren't adequate. You didn't consider our reliance and interests in terms of preventing or deterring illegal immigration. You didn't consider the policy's benefits, et cetera, et cetera. District judge ruled in their favor, enjoined the policy. The Fifth Circuit upheld the injunction, and then the Supreme Court did as well. Then, again, this gets complicated, but then the administration appealed to the Fifth Circuit on the merits. And then a few days just before the oral arguments at the Fifth Circuit, it released a new memo laying out its arguments or elaborating a little more on why it was terminating the policy and asked the Fifth Circuit to vacate the district court's judgment under this kind of this doctrine known as the Munsingware Doctrine, in which a case, when it becomes moot, the district court vacates the injunction. And so this is, again, where we are now. The Fifth Circuit refused to vacate the injunction, saying this case is not moot, and it's not, because really the fundamental issue is whether the administration can terminate remain in Mexico, and they didn't follow the proper legal procedure in terms of putting out this new memo, they would have had to take a completely fresh look, as the Supreme Court justices said in the Trump DACA rescission. You have to go back to the drawing board. You can't just elaborate on your reasoning a little more with a post hoc rationalization.
But the upshot is that we're in a little bit of an awkward posture here, because the Biden administration has been ordered by the judiciary to continue a policy that it is actively trying to rescind. And so there's a February article by the Washington Post I was looking at, and the headline is, "Remain in Mexico is back under Biden with little resemblance to the Trump version." It says that Trump sent nearly 70,000 asylum seekers back to Mexico. The biggest difference under Biden has been the scale of the returns. His administration was ordered to restore it in good faith, but the court did not set quotas. So far, the Department of Homeland Security has sent back about 410 enrollees in the program. And so, Kim, this is a fascinating one to watch, and it comes down, again, some of the arguments to the Administrative Procedure Act. And did the administration follow the rules that it was supposed to go through, the analysis, the public comment, and so forth, when it was trying to get rid of this policy?
Well, the quick answer to that is no, it absolutely did not. And as Alicia was just going through, it's been also trying to use this little memo jockeying to get out of having to go back to the drawing board and do the work. Essentially, they're bringing up this new memo saying, well, because this is a new memo, then all the prior things we've done don't count, and therefore the lawsuit that has been brought doesn't count, and we just get to keep motoring ahead and nothing applies to us. And there was a great quote from the Fifth Circuit judge who wrote the opinion here. Said the government's theory of mootness would allow an administrative agency to permanently avoid judicial review by issuing an endless litany of new memos to moot every adverse judicial ruling. This is a game of heads I win, tails I win, and I win without even bothering to flip the coin, end quote. So I think that the Fifth Circuit certainly feels as though the administration has been playing games here. And then it also gets to the question of whether or not the law that this is based on, which was that 1996 bipartisan immigration reform that Alicia mentioned, and the legal basis for Remain in Mexico, whether it even allows the administration to end this policy, and that law contains an order from Congress that migrants who cross a border shall be detained, and that if there is not enough room, they will be returned to Mexico. There is some discretion for the administration to parole on a case-by-case basis, but that's not what's happening here. And in fact, that Washington Post story you mentioned shows that while they have restarted the migrant protocol or Remain in Mexico, that they're not even really enforcing it in any real effect. They've done it with so many outs and so leniently in terms of who it applies to that no one's in fact being returned. So there's a lot of things at play here, the administrative aspect of it, the law, and also the implementation of the policy. And you heard Chief Justice John Roberts touching on part of that in his pretty aggressive probing there in the case.
Right, because this 1996 law says that migrants shall be detained. And reminder what the Chief Justice was saying. He was asking, if Congress only provides for 34,000 beds in the Department of Homeland Security, that's the detention capacity, and it's wholly inadequate to the task at hand, is Congress in effect changing the policy or not giving the White House, the administration, whichever one is in office, the tools it needs to fulfill that command in the 1996 law? But the other thing, Alicia, that jumps out at me here about this argument about this 1996 law is, if the Remain in Mexico policy was negotiated by President Trump, then how can it be that it was required under this 1996 law up until the point that Trump negotiated it?
Well, I guess the argument from Texas would be it was effectively required, but you have to go back to 1996. Okay, it was intended as a safety valve. So if there isn't enough detention beds, then may. So the operative word actually in the text is the DHS may return the migrants to the contiguous country, in this case, Mexico. This has become an effective mandate because there aren't enough detention beds. there just isn't the space. And you have to also consider in previous administrations actually did use the Remain in Mexico on a case kind of case by case base. And they used the separate authority to parole migrants for quote unquote urgent humanitarian reasons and significant public benefits. But they also used that on very more sparingly on a case by case base. They also used other immigration powers that Congress gave them, expedited removals. The problem here with the Biden administration is they're not using any of these. I mean, they've been really leaning on this Title 42 under the CDC's authority to expel migrants during a public health crisis, but they've basically abandoned all the authorities that Congress has given them over the decades to deal with the migration crisis, and that's the problem that they're now facing.
Well, Title 42 is where I was going next, and this is the expedited removal under public health powers. And this week, Kim, there was a federal judge in Louisiana that signaled he may block the administration, the White House, from ending the Title 42 process. What effect do you think that that will have on this whole situation?
Well, first we'll see just what the administration does in response to that temporary restraining order, which is, by the way, what this judge has done. He has not necessarily ruled on the merits and said that the CDC cannot end Title 42, but rather this action was taken in response to three states, Missouri, Louisiana, and Arizona, who sued and made the argument that the federal government was already taking early steps to disregard Title 42, even though it isn't set to end until May 23rd. And even, by the way, the Department of Homeland Security acknowledged that it had begun processing some migrants from Central America under pre-pandemic guidelines. And so it essentially admitted to the court that it was already taking steps to wrap up Title 42. So the judges said, no, you can't do that. And I guess one question is going to be, as we've seen with Remain in Mexico, just because a court orders the administration to do something, they tend to take a very expansive view of their administrative authority and find creative ways to get around it. And that's what they've been doing with Remain in Mexico, which even though it's technically back in effect, they're barely using it at all. So this raises a really interesting question, which is we're having this legal fight about Title 42. We're having this legal fight about Remain in Mexico. But if you have an administration that is simply determined not to police the border and not to follow these laws, it's an interesting question of where you go from there. I suppose more lawsuits and more court orders. But it seems at the moment that there is a feeling in the White House that they need to cater to those in their party that are very much for a more open border mentality, and that you can issue all the orders you want. They're not going to move any faster.
But it is remarkable how this has become a political problem, maybe not for President Biden yet, because he's not up for re-election yet, but for Democrats, Senate Democrats. Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, she's up for re-election. She was recently this month at the southern border, a long way from New Hampshire. She says it's her third trip to the southern border. Her office posted some photos. Here she is at the border wall with a couple of Border Patrol agents. There she is looking across what looks like a river. I can only assume it's the Rio Grande. And Alicia, I find it remarkable how many of these Democrats feel like they need to, for political reasons, buck the White House's line here.
Oh, well, I think that's right. I mean, they're looking at the polling right now on the illegal immigration, which has really turned even in the last year. Partly that's because they're seeing the big surge in migrants and their concerns about both border security as well as, to be honest, the welfare state. I mean, being able to support all of these migrants. And most of them, again, are on the southern border, but the Biden administration has been using air flights to take them to other parts of the country. So I think this is a real liability for the Biden administration. You're seeing it in these swing states where senators are taking a pretty strong stand against the rescission of the planned rescission of Title 42. In my honest opinion, I think, you know, the administration should rescind Title 42. It's a long time. It's a public health emergency power. When Congress enacted the law, was intended to prevent the spread of communicable diseases or introductions. But look, COVID has been with us for over 2 years. You know, it started the danger of, you know, Mexicans or migrants coming from Mexico introducing COVID and spreading it in the U.S., it no longer exists to the extent that, you know, it's already spreading, it's endemic in the U.S. So I think actually continuing this policy is kind of an abuse of executive authority and abuse of emergency powers. The better solution would be actually just for Congress to extend it on its own, which I think would be a better, or would show more respect for the separation of powers, or to return to the return to Mexico policy, which is clearly authorized by the law.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. The big business story on Monday was that after about a two-week courtship, and not always a loving one, Elon Musk has come to a deal, $44 billion, to buy the social site Twitter. And Kim, this is a remarkable story just on the business terms. He's apparently pledged to put up about $21 billion of his own money if he needs to, though he could also have some other investors come in on that. And he has pledged to put up some of his Tesla stock as collateral on some debt. So it is a big gamble for the world's richest man.
Yes, it's a big gamble. And I think that when Elon Musk first announced that he was interested in buying Twitter, people thought, oh, you know, super wealthy dude, even though it looked like some really big numbers, $43 billion, people didn't really think much about that. Now that you actually dig in and see that this amounts to about 10% of his net worth, and that he has pledged all that Tesla stock as collateral on the debt, it really shows what a important move this was for him, how much he was willing to bet on it. And how important, by the way, too, it's going to be that Elon Musk make this a financial success. Because all of the discussion so far has really been about Elon Musk's interest in free speech and how he wants to change Twitter policies to make it more of a true public square. But the reality is that he's also going to have to figure out a more workable business model. Twitter was already under a lot of pressure to increase and do better with its finances. It had pledged to double its revenue to $7.5 billion this year and to grow its active users. The question now for Musk is, can some of his creative thinking unlock some of the company's potential? Or does some of the changes he make to Twitter actually put it more at risk of, for instance, losing advertisers, etc.? It's a big bet.
On that point, here was a statement from Musk on Monday. He said, "Free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, and Twitter is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated. I also want to make Twitter better than ever by enhancing the product with new features, making the algorithms open source to increase trust, defeating the spam bots, and authenticating all humans," unquote. And so some interesting ideas there. We know Elon Musk has spoken favorably about providing a function where you could edit a tweet that you'd already sent. He seems to be in favor of longer tweets in some cases. And this idea, Alicia, of authenticating all humans is an interesting one, because I don't know how successful Twitter could be at that, but that would be a way to allow for unfettered debate and open speech while still providing some measure of responsibility, because people would have to stand behind their words.
Yes, but I'm not sure that that's going to prevent people, you know, from brawling. And basically what Twitter often seems to be is, you know, a bar at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and people just, you know, lash out and they say things without thinking twice. And I'm not sure the edit button is actually going to make a difference in that respect. If anything, it may actually encourage people to be a little more impetuous. They may not watch what they say because they figure, hey, you know, I can go back and edit it later. And just going back to Kim's point, who knows if any of these changes will make a difference in terms of the finances of the company. Obviously, Musk is going to have to pay back the debt that he's using to finance the deal. I think I read that the interest payments are basically would cover the entire company's cash flow. So he's going to have to grow that revenue and probably have to grow the user base. Twitter actually only has about 200 or so million active daily users, which is about 100 million less than, you know, Snapchat, which is really kind of incredible once you think about it. And I think the way to do that, one way obviously is perhaps to allow, you know, more free speech, but you're also going to have to expand it to beyond the, you know, the elite. Right now, yes, there are some, you know, celebrities use it, you know, social influencers use it. But really, the reason why the intellectual class and the intelligentsia has gotten so upset, worked up about Musk's buyout is because it really is a platform for the elites, for the intellectuals of society who've kind of followed the news and such. And but I think in order to really increase revenue and profits, you're going to have to expand it out to more people.
And there has been some conservative schadenfreude lately, jumping off on some of those reactions from people who say that Musk is going to ruin the platform. He's going to let trolls run wild. And I agree. I think he will be constrained somewhat by the need to keep these advertisers happy. Advertising is about 90% of Twitter's revenue, at least right now. As for the free speech point, here's something that Musk said on Monday. I hope that even my worst critics remain on Twitter, because that is what free speech means. And I think we'll have to wait to see the rest of his vision. But one question, Kim, that he will surely face is, are you going to let President Trump back on Twitter? And does President Trump even want to go back on Twitter? He is saying that he does not want to. He's saying that he's sticking with his own social media site, Truth Social. However, I'm a little bit skeptical, and I think that if they allowed him back on, he would find it hard to resist all those likes and retweets.
Yeah, especially because I don't think Truth Social has necessarily got the mojo right now that Twitter does, and we'll see if it even ever gets there. We've been hearing a long time about this social media platform, but it hasn't really broke through the ether yet. Look, Musk has said that he is uncomfortable with the idea of bans on Twitter. So it won't just be Donald Trump. I think there'll be some other prominent people who have been thrown off, where there's now going to be a discussion or a decision about whether or not to put them back on. But one of the things that I find fascinating about this is, if you just listen to the apocalyptic claims of Twitter employees at the moment, or those on the left who really prefer Twitter to be this place where they get to decide what is acceptable discussion. These are the folks right now out there essentially arguing that democracy now depends on more Twitter content moderation, which is really quite astonishing. Nobody is probably arguing that you want Twitter to be a place full of people egging on violence or other things that are essentially illegal. But that is not what actually has really bothered most people about Twitter. And in that regard, I think Musk could do a lot of good without being even overly aggressive, in that, you know, the issue we've had is not necessarily, again, these questions of violence. It's Twitter, for instance, shutting down any conversations about the origins of COVID, for instance, or shutting down those who disagree with the prevailing wisdom on climate change. And so instead of allowing just speech on things that are debatable topics, just deciding that certain things are beyond the pale and that they're not going to let you talk about them at all. So simply starting there would probably restore some real confidence in Twitter and its policies for a lot of people. He's also talked about, for instance, making the algorithms public, those that either promote or demote tweets, so that people understand and have more confidence in the way that this actually works. Obviously, we've had a lot of discussion about shadow bans. There's other things too, edit features for tweets. He's talked about moving more to a subscription model, which Twitter has a pilot project for at the moment, kind of this small scale thing called Twitter Blue, where you pay. Musk has talked about moving away from advertisements and more toward that. So there's a lot of things that he can do. And I think it'll be interesting to see where he starts.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.